Hi, Squale, and welcome to another episode of Conversations in the Arts and Humanities. In these conversations, we introduce you to the scholars and alumni of the Arts and Humanities faculty at Vancouver Island University and discuss their latest research. I'm your host, Bryn Skibo, Professor of English at VIU. Before we start, we would like to acknowledge and give thanks to the Sinemuk, Kowatsin, Tlamin, Tsunawas, Qualicum First Nations on whose traditional lands we teach, learn, research, live, and share knowledge. Since 2009, the Faculty of Arts and Humanities has presented The Colloquium, a series of lectures that brings our faculty and alumni's practices and research to the public. In today's episode, I chat live with Delaney Vallon, who earned a bachelor's degree in 2018 from VIU's Creative Writing Department. In 2022, Delaney published her first book of poetry entitled Shapeshifters with Knightwood Editions. And in 2024, she completed her master's degree at Royal Roads University in professional communications. Her master's thesis, entitled A Jig in Three Parts, received a nomination for a Governor General Gold Medal, and her poetry has been awarded the Malahat Review's Long Poem Prize and Subterrane's Lush Triumphant Award. Her work has appeared in Prism International, Adbusters, Room, and in the anthologies Those Who Make Us and Bowajigan, Stories of Power. Delaney is Métis with Nehiya, Salto, French-Canadian, and Czech ancestry. Her colloquium presentation this Friday is entitled Living Between Worlds, a Métis Counseling Experience, and it builds on her expertise in creative writing and research to explore the intersecting forms of treatment and healing from within and between Euro-American and Métis perspectives. Welcome, Delaney, and thank you so much for joining me in the studio today.
Thanks so much, Rin, Tanché. It's really, really good to be here.
Tanché. Let's jump in. You have the honor of being the colloquium's first alumna to keynote her own colloquium lecture. Congratulations.
Thank you. It's like a huge honor, and I'm really excited to be able to have this opportunity to share some of the things that I've been working on and to just be in conversation with other students and faculty members and really just take that opportunity to give back and share, because it's been a really rich journey starting at VIU.
That's awesome. We are very excited to have you back on campus. I have been telling all my students, and faculty members are aware of it. We're pretty excited to have you back. Your studies at VIU preceded my joining of the faculty. So can you tell me and listeners a little bit about your experience? What was the creative writing program like, and how did it inform your later work?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that I kind of want to be transparent about my sort of circuitous journey through the program and throughout all of my academic experience, really, because I think that it's important to share that. Like, it wasn't like a clean, neat, linear experience for me. So actually, when I first started at VIU, I was experiencing some challenges with depression and just with trying to fit in and find my voice and place of belonging. And I actually ended up kind of dropping out from school twice.
Wow.
Yeah. And then I came back, you know, that second time. And then I really focused and I guess took myself seriously as a student and as a writer. I gave myself permission to really take some risks and put myself out there. And what I found in the program is, like, when I had, you know, the courage to show up, even after those sorts of experiences that I could have qualified as failures, but really feel like learning experiences to me now, faculty and students and like fellow peers were really there to support me. So I feel like I had a really powerful experience where I was able to take those risks in a safer environment. And, you know, start submitting things to literary journals and get those first sort of publications to build my confidence up. But I guess I want to mention that circuitous journey, because I think so often in academia, there's this pressure to do 100%. Things in a very specific kind of rigid way. And I think, you know, some people, they've dropped out and they're thinking they want to go back, and will it be the same? Will it be just as challenging? And I guess I just want to use like my experience as an example to say, like, it's first of all, it's never too late. And if you're in it and it's not going the way you hoped, it's not too late.
That's awesome. Thank you for sharing that. I'm so glad that you shared that story, because we have a lot of students who, at least in my classes, will sometimes mention, oh, I'm, you know, coming back, and I initially started my studies in insert year here, and I'm coming back again. And they kind of like mention it like sotto voce, like kind of whispering it. And I'm like, it's great that you're back. Welcome back. That is a big step. And it's, I was just offered a poem to my students by Kwasolwat, who's Ellen White. She's a Sonamic elder. She was a Sonamic elder who worked on the campus for a very long time. And in the poem, she reflects that when we fall in public and all we take away from it is embarrassment, that's the lesson that you learn with shame. But if you fall and you take something else away from it, even if you fall in the dark and no one sees it and you don't need to be embarrassed, you can still, she says at one point in the poem, to touch it, taste it, feel it. And from that, then you've learned something, and that's the actual experience. And
that's beautiful.
It's a lovely poem. It's so short. I shared it with my students after the midterm to say, basically,
yes,
like, it's okay.
Yes.
If you failure is a learning opportunity. So I'm glad that
Absolutely.
That was the experience you had too.
Yeah.
Speaking of publishing things, turning things into publications afterwards, you published Shapeshifters, your first book of poetry. I say first because I assume there will be more.
I hope so.
You published Shapeshifters in 2022, 4 years after you graduated from the creative writing program. Was Shapeshifters a part of some of the projects that you were doing in the project in the program, or was it something that sprang up spontaneously after you left?
Yeah, a lot of the poems actually I started writing in the program. And I think there's one in particular with Jay Ruzeski. I wrote in his class, and it was a long poem. And it's so rare that we have the opportunity to kind of explore poetry with that kind of breadth, but this was actually a course tailored to long form poetry. And I decided to really reckon with my Métis identity from a bunch of different angles. It was incredibly difficult to write because at that time I wasn't really solid in my identity and who I am from that Métis perspective. And I didn't know that I had a lot of authority from which to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an ongoing journey of reconnection, of course. But that really was a powerful experience, and that ended up being like such a central piece in the book. And there were others as well. The persona poems, I have several of them, and they take on the voices of different, capitalist mascots.
Mm-hmm.
And I came to that through like the generosity of another former faculty member, Marilyn Bowering. And I was sort of feeling a little blocked. And I kind of slumped into her office, and she gave me this book by Carol Ann Duffy called A World's Wife. And in it, Duffy writes from the perspective of a lot of different fairy tale characters. And it was this beautiful realization that I didn't always have to mine my own stuff.
Yeah.
I could write from other perspectives. And that those also, a lot of those ended up in the book as well. So I think that like sometimes it can feel like the work that we create, on campus or in a context of a class, it can just sort of like live and die in that space. But actually that's not always true. Like sometimes those works can carry through. They can live in journals, they can live in zines, they can live in all sorts of, online and in books. So I think treating it that way, it's really a lot more motivating to write then, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I'm so glad that you mentioned that too, because it's true. Sometimes the conversations that we have within the classroom walls, like those really rich ones, not to use slang, but like the fire conversations where stuff's just snapping and popping. And then sometimes it can feel a little deflating when you leave and you're like, well, that's it. That conversation will never exist again. And so I always try to remind my students, and I'm starting to really emphasize it in my teaching, like you can go to conferences. You can try and publish papers. There are academic journals that specialize in student research. So I'm so glad that you mentioned that. Like, this stuff, the conversation maybe is where it starts, and when the, and then we keep it going by taking it somewhere else.
Yeah, I'm glad that you say that too, because I think also it's never too early to start. Like,
yes.
Even if you're, oh, I'm just an undergrad.
Yeah.
It's like, actually, no, like you have something to contribute here.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, I love it. So you mentioned some of these persona poems. So I had wanted to talk about that a little bit. You've discussed in other interviews and on your biography on poetrycanada.org that you are neurodivergent, having been diagnosed with autism. And in a 2023 interview with Rob Taylor, you also reflected on a moment in your writing career when you felt painted into the identity, as you called it, of said person, capital S, capital P, which you escaped by writing from the perspective of invented personas, which you that emerged from that conversation with Marilyn Bowering. And these personas often relate to corporate mascots. I read Mrs. Clean last night.
Yes.
From the title of one of your poems. She is the fictional wife of Mr. Clean. I know many listeners, myself included, may be part of the neurodivergent community, which can sometimes feel like a real gift and other times feel incredibly frustrating. Can you reflect on your own experiences and how perhaps they manifest in your poetry or in your writing?
Yeah, of course. And I think that's a really good point. Like it is at times a gift and at times a frustration. Like there's a reason I wear my noise canceling headphones everywhere. Yeah. I go, right? Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm late diagnosed as autistic, and I also have an ADHD diagnosis that I came to later as an adult. And the reason for seeking those out is, of course, like this ever continuing quest to understand myself a little bit better. But it's also like a lot of things that I create, it's driven by this question of belonging.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wanted to find that sense of community. I didn't really have very adequate mirroring growing up. I was kind of feeling a little strange, a little othered a lot of the time, which I think is not uncommon for those of us who are in that neurodivergent umbrella.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, like seeking out those diagnoses was a way to kind of connect myself to like a broader community and find people who I resonated with.
Nice.
And I guess how that manifests in the writing, especially with that sad person sort of identity, is I think even with a label like autism, there's always a caution in not over-identifying with a label, and especially when it comes from the DSM, mm-hmm. the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for like how we, you know, can sometimes pathologize these differences.
Yeah.
And so I think that, there's been kind of a tendency in myself to pigeonhole myself into mm-hmm. one specific kind of identity. And for a while in my early 20s, that was the sad person. And it really blocked my ability to express myself in writing. And, you know, when I did receive that book from Marilyn Bowering, it helped me kind of open up different perspectives, because I thought, well, I'm not going to write from the perspective of fairy tales or those mm-hmm. kinds of characters. And I would have liked to have written from the perspective of the stories and characters in Mi'kmaq and Métis traditions.
Yes.
But I didn't have access to those growing up because of colonization. And, you know, like my grandmother was an Indian day school survivor. So we had a lot of that knowledge kind of wiped out. So what I did grow up with were TV advertisements and, you know, characters in the pantry, right?
Yeah.
Like, and I wanted to know, what would it be like? What's their inner life? Like, if they're kind of being, you know, sold off by these like corporate executives, like what is their experience? and I accessed, you know, this like anger at times, or this humor at other times, and like the whole range of human emotion through these characters. And it helped me also access more of myself as well.
That's so interesting. That's such an interesting thought experiment, and also just like an inherently fun experiment, but the way that it kind of accesses these deeper layers of our own selves, but through kind of the joy or the humor. I'm like, as you're talking about it, I'm like, Tony the Tiger definitely goes to CrossFit.
Yes, definitely.
I'm like, Mr. Kool-Aid Man is deeply sad. He's just putting so much out. He's actually an introvert.
Yes.
But he has to perform this extrovert.
It's a mask.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
That's awesome. But it's like then that idea that through this joy and through this humor of creating these characters to kind of reappropriate them in a way, you're actually doing this really personal, deep work mm-hmm. of exploring. That's fascinating. And I kind of want to go practice this a little bit myself. That's so fun.
Well, I haven't written Tony the Tiger, so that's yours if you want it.
I'm excited to see what you would do with Mr. Kool-Aid. So talking about, let's dive into your poetry a little bit. In Shapeshifters, I'm new to your poetry. I've heard a lot about it from colleagues of mine. And so I had the opportunity in advance of this interview to read it, which was just such a joy. In Shapeshifters, you offer a prose poem entitled, "What Are the Ethics of Picking a Stinging Plant?" which won Prism International's Grouse Grind Literary Prize for very short form, very short forms, which I find a very ironic prize, by the way, for anybody who has done the grouse grind. It is not short.
No, it doesn't feel short.
It doesn't feel like a short form. And so I have some questions about the poem, but just for listeners who might not be aware of the poem, I'm just going to give you like a little bit of an audio visual version of the poem. So it is comprised of four paragraphs. The first two paragraphs describe the speaker's quote unquote daydreaming about picking stinging nettles, with the second paragraph ending, quote, I felt real peace here last summer when I filled bags with blackberries to burst, but neither fruit nor thorn knew my name on this land, so I haunt their patches like a ghost. The next two paragraphs, which end the prose poem, shift this daydream into reflections about the speaker's identity, with the speaker opening this section by saying, quote, the problem is that I'm a stranger to myself. The speaker of the poem and Nettle, the personification of the stinging plants, then briefly converse about the speaker's identity, their official paperwork being, quote, at home, and the speaker states that, quote, I'm just trying to be here. The poem ends with some form of resolution between the speaker and Nettle, but obviously it's complicated. That was an extremely generalized summary of the poem, and I really recommend that listeners read it. It's available at Delaney's poetrycanada.org page, which I'll put in our show notes on the Conversation website. Delaney will also be reading this poem herself at colloquium. It's very weird to read a poem in front of the writer of the poem. So it's safe to say that the poem can be read in many ways. But one thing that is apparent is the speaker's connection to Nettle's land, the speaker's connection to their own homeland, and the speaker's sense of self, which is caught between these two places. For me, these lines, quote, I felt real peace here last summer, I haunt their patches like a ghost, and I'm just trying to be here. These lines really resonated with me as someone who is also not from Nanaimo. Heck, I'm not even from Canada. But as someone who is very aware of what this land means to the Snoqmiyik people, what do these lines mean to you? How do you understand your connection to the land here in Snoqmiyik territory versus how do you understand your connection to the land back home?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And so for me, like I was alluding to earlier, like a lot of what I examine is about this question of belonging. And I think it's because I have so much in my life felt this sense of displacement, which is actually a very common story for a lot of us Métis. My grandmother was born in Meadow Lake, Saskatchewan, so northern Saskatchewan. And then they moved. My mother was born in Hay River, Northwest Territories. And then they moved to Edmonton, Alberta, and where she met my father, who was actually from Quebec City. And they moved back to Quebec City, had me. That's where I was born. Mm-hmm. And then we moved here onto Snoqmiyik territory when I was about 9. So I've never felt at home anywhere. Like, I've been to, you know, a lot of Métis people go to Batoche, Saskatchewan. That's sort mm-hmm. of like this site of this great reunion that happens. It's like a national historic site now, so it's a little bit weird, but every year there's this big gathering called Back to Batoche, and a lot of Métis families and kin go there and meet. And I've been to Batoche only once, but it really like has made a strong impression in my mind. I have, you know, ancestors who are buried there. Mm-hmm. It's the site of the 1885 resistance. Mm-hmm. And it's also, for a lot of us, the site of where things really went wrong, where we became what is called now road allowance people. So after that happened, a lot of Métis people were pushed out and literally lived on the side of the roads, like in tents, as we know from Maria Campbell's account in Half Breed, in her seminal book there, you know, eating things like roasted gopher meat and just really being displaced. And the federal government enacted this this scrip system, which is a coupon system that really disadvantaged Métis people, because essentially it gave them this right to claim land that was really unviable and very distanced from the historic communities that they're from, or they could exchange it for like a lump sum of cash, which wasn't very much. And so this whole system like really informs like how I interact with like the land on which I live as somebody who is a settler here, who lives here uninvited, but who also doesn't feel like I have a home anywhere. Like right. It's just kind of, and I think that's why there's this palpable feeling of being a ghost, you know, of haunting. And so, yeah, the relationship with nettle in the poem is based on a real relationship that I've cultivated with this nettle patch through visiting, through going back and spending time with nettle and reflecting on my own relationship to myself. Because I think, you know, sometimes Métis identity especially can get caught up in this sort of bureaucratic understanding. Like we work so hard to prove who we are. We have to have all this documentation. But what does it actually mean to be Métis, you know, and to carry that sense of dispossession and kinship at once, right? Like it's really, and that's kind of that tension of living between worlds that I allude to in the colloquium as well. So I think, yeah, for me, it's like how to cultivate relationships with these beings on the land, but not at the expense, like, can I find this to be upsetting sometimes in like some ecological spheres, like there's this real concerted effort to cultivate relationships with like what is maybe called like the other than human world, right? And I think that's so important, but not at the expense of the people who've been here at time immemorial, like making sure that like it's not just we're including them in the conversation, like they have, like there needs to be like a felt sense that they're leading these conversations as well.
Yeah.
So it's that kind of like, okay, how do I navigate this with respect and with all of that in mind, like as someone who is, yeah, like a settler here as well.
Yeah. That's given me a lot to think about. Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm just in the studio. I'm kind of like staring open mouthed as I reflect on all the things. So let me, that doesn't play well on the radio. So, let's talk briefly about the colloquium, because we'll have to wrap up in just a second. But you mentioned the colloquium, things that you'll be talking about in the colloquium, this kind of walking between worlds. The colloquium, as I mentioned, on Friday, 10 a.m. in Malaspina Theater is entitled Living Between Worlds, Métis Counseling Experiences. What can we expect at the colloquium?
Yeah, so I was really inspired actually by our spooky season. Like this is happening at the end of October. So I've decided to kind of frame the colloquium as a question around what is haunting like the therapeutic space between counselors and Métis clients. So we're going to be looking at like the power dynamics and how that might replicate like historical injustice. We're going to be looking at how Métis identity gets brought into the counseling room or not. And also just how institutions are training and preparing therapists and training to interact with Métis clients. And we're going to be doing that with poetry, with other Métis poets as well, and with quotations from the research that I've done and gathered. So I'm hoping that it's going to be a polyvocal experience.
That's amazing. I like that idea of a polyvocal experience. We need to wrap up. So I'm just, instead of our usual rapid fire round, we'll just do one rapid fire round. If you could get listeners to read one poem today, what would it be?
I think it would be First Time Smudge by Molly Cross Blanchard, another Métis poet. And it's really funny. Her whole book, Exhibitionist, is hilarious. I would recommend that.
That's awesome. Thank you so much, Delaney. It was such a pleasure. Thank you so much, Bren. You good? Colloquium, which will run on Friday, 10 o'clock, in the Malaspina Theater on VIU's campus. Next up, we have Leon Potter's colloquium on November 28th, when he presents Two Truths and an AI. Leon and I will begin be in studio live on November 26th, 10 a.m., CHLY, 101.7 FM Nanaimo, and thank you so much as well to RB Frew, Tyla and Carter, our radio tech assistants in studio today. Carter, you did a great job running the show today. Thanks so much.